So Richard, part of your answer, fundamental to your answer really, is that you like using local knowledge. And that's why you're departing runway 35. But local knowledge also says that you don't depart in the middle of the day, which is what you're about to do. So how do you reconcile those two things for someone who might not have as much experience in high density altitude conditions as you do?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jeff. And it's a scenario that I saw time and again flying out there this past summer, that people would tell you that don't fly between, you know, 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., but then you would see them flying. And what I learned from it was that's a good general guide to start from. And this is where local knowledge helps, I think, is it's a really good starting place. And then from there, you factor in all the situations and the conditions that are impacting you and your flying, your airplane and your proficiency and your comfort level. And then, like always, you make your own decision based on that. So in this case, you know, that 10 to 6 window, we're going to fly in the middle of that because the winds are lighter than normal. With the winds only being 19 knots at the peaks, that's not bad. So that's reasonable flying. At the same time, the reason why I'd rather depart runway 35 is, to me, it seems more practical to stay with the local wisdom and do that, because there's no reason really not to. A small tailwind doesn't bother me.
That makes sense to me. I'm curious whether there's anyone at the table who would depart differently, either the spiral up over the airport, or you've got a turbocharged airplane, you're going south anyway, just depart runway 17, plenty of room to climb and gain some altitude heading in that direction. Any takers? Not a one. Now, I'm wondering, everyone here has had chance to really look at this scenario and also to even look at a video that we'll put in the resources from a local pilot. If you didn't know from the sort of local procedures, you just came into this airport, you stopped, you're leaving in the middle of the day, and you were just looking at it, and you knew you were going southbound, just based without knowing that's what people did locally, how tempted would people be to just take off in that direction, not knowing about the things that had happened, Paul?
I think they might be tempted. And assuming that the airplane has sufficient performance, which Richard has assured us by his POH review that it does, you could take off on 17. You'd have the benefit of about a 3-knot headwind for the takeoff. The terrain, and the valley is narrower in that direction, and the terrain rises a little bit higher, but it seems adequate to me that you could make that departure work. It just doesn't have the margin of going north. What I like about going north is the valley is pretty wide. It gets wider, and I would do the same thing. I would really hug that high terrain to the east. That way, if things aren't looking good, you can easily loop back to runway 17 for landing. You'd have a slight headwind. And if things really go bad, you've got the lake up there. And the lake is, if you have to put the airplane down, is always a good option. So I think 17 is okay. It's just not as good as 35. And all my accident reviews, I've seen a lot of accidents out of Angel Flyer. In fact, as soon as I saw that airport name, that airport.
Well, that's one of the things from that YouTube video that we'll have in the resources or in the hangar discussion, that the accidents were controlled flight into terrain for rising terrain to the south. So if you knew about those, it definitely could dissuade you from going in that direction. You know, you brought something up, Paul, about hugging the terrain. And I learned to fly out in Colorado, so it was something that was kind of part of basic pilot training for private pilots. But when I've showed the technique to other people, what I discovered was people were pretty reticent to get as close to the terrain as you really need to be to gain the benefit. And I'm wondering, because we have a number of pilots at the table and everyone's kind of nodding on that technique, how does a pilot become comfortable with that? And how close do you think you need to be? How much of a gain would it really be if you weren't, when you say hugging, like really hugging the terrain? How does one become proficient on that sort of thing?
That'd be something that glider flying would really help, because the mechanical lift that glider pilots get from wind and rising terrain is a real art for them, and they use it pretty aggressively. It's true that it's like you do have to get uncomfortably close to get the benefit, but you know, as you approach that terrain and the lift, I would expect that you just need to get close enough to, until your VSI starts going up noticeably, you know, and it's pretty clear how close you need to be. You know, your vertical speed indicator will tell you. And I agree with most of the what Richard spelled out in this scenario. I mean, it's like taking off a runway 3-5, you know, agreed, hugging the terrain on the east side of the valley to get that mechanical lift. I think that's smart too. The only things that I'd quibble with is you know, he was saying that the most conservative thing to do is to wait till evening and cooler temperatures to depart. I disagree. I think the option that he's chosen is the most conservative. You know, the idea of flying single engine over the mountains at night, which was what you'd be setting yourself up for if you left in the evening, you know, that to me is a high risk scenario that I wouldn't want to take any part of. I think Richard's actually chosen the most conservative approach.
Michael.
You know, I'm from the East Coast like some of you guys, and I'm not a mountain pilot. And, you know, I've heard all kinds of stories and talked to all kinds of people about it. And one of the things I would say is I wouldn't really attempt it unless I actually had mountain training out there, because I would profess that I'm not a mountain pilot. And there's so much to be learned from that, like, I just wouldn't attempt it. And we talk about being really conservative. I think I'd wait till the next morning and do it when it's cold outside, right? My high altitude experience is doing air shows at Reno. And just from that, knowing that my airplane at 70 degrees in the morning and my airplane at 95 degrees in the afternoon are two different things. And temperature is huge out there as far as density altitude goes.
Ian.
Yeah, you were asking, Jeff, how do you learn to do this, or how do you go about figuring out how close you need to be to that terrain? And my thought was, by all means, do it with an instructor or someone who is proficient. Don't just try to figure it out by yourself before you do that. And so that's definitely something that needs some good instruction. And I had the similar thought that I'm not sure that option one was the most conservative choice. And what that one does for me is it makes me wish there was that sixth choice of waiting until the next morning. But since we don't have that, I guess we can't choose that one. But by the time we get to the point where we have to fly over that high terrain at night in a piston-powered airplane, even if it is turbocharged, then maybe that's not such a great idea.
But you know, I'd see this. It's an 85 degree day. The winds are manageable. It doesn't seem like a super high risk thing. You can expect a 600 foot per minute rate of climb. You know, you've got to climb for about 10 minutes until you're above the summits of the mountains. You know, 13,000 feet, the highest summits in that area. When I looked at these scenarios, I was not tempted to wait a day.
How much did the turbocharger factor into that for you? Obviously, the climb rate does, but you know, if you were seeing for a non-turbocharged plane, a climb rate of, oh, I'm just going to pick round numbers here, like 350 or something like that, or 4, because you may be extrapolating on the chart anyway. Would that sway it for you, Dave, or anyone else about like, I mean, because it is still a pretty big valley. You got an 8,000 foot runway to abort from. There's a lot of room if you're going looping it and staying in the valley, Dave.
You know, I've got to say that I've got a severe prejudice against turbocharged engines. I find them to run hot. I find them to be, relatively unreliable. You know, there's all sorts of failure modes and partial failures that come with turbocharged engines. You know, when you look at the POH for the aero, you know, they make a big point out of cruise climb, cool the cylinders, you know, don't do a prolonged climb at VY, because turbochargers in most piston airplanes, you know, are a horrible invention. I don't like them, and they don't, you know, they're not worth the trouble that they cause, in my opinion. You know, I'm curious how alone I am on that thought. With the rest of the group.
5,000 SR-22T owners might disagree with you. you know, the thing about the turbocharging is it's not turning night to day, but it's giving you an edge that you wouldn't have in a normally aspirated airplane. And might as well be honest about it, turbocharged airplanes crash in these circumstances too, because you look at the POH and it says, oh, 600 feet a minute, and you put that in the bank and you take off and, oh, what's this? It's only 500 feet a minute. I wasn't planning on that. And that's fairly common because the engine may be doing its part, but the propeller and the wing are definitely not.
And, you know, those turbocharged Cirri, the people who fly them, they fly them generally like normally aspirated airplanes. You know, sometimes you see them up in the flight levels, but a lot of times you don't, you know. So it's like even planes with turbochargers, they fly at non-oxygen altitudes. And
they fly commonly in the teens, in the mid to high teens. That's a good sweet spot for the SR.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, that's one more reason why I despise turbocharged airplanes, is that people mostly fly them like normally aspirated ones. I fly normally aspirated airplanes in the teens. The thing is with a turbocharger, I mean, that thing is costing you performance all the time. You know, I mean, it's just creating more work for the engine to do. Your fuel burns worse, your range is worse. Turbochargers, I'll stop my rant, but it's like, I'm not a fan.
John, did you have a comment there?
Yeah, I wanted to echo what Michael and Dean said too. For me, it's not being a mountain pilot, not being just being an East Coast flatlander. I'd wait for the next morning also. You were going to Scottsdale in the morning anyhow, or for an overnighter. So it's no penalty that way. And I looked at I did a density altitude calculation. It's actually 11,470 feet is the density altitude at that temperature and at pressure. So it's going to have a serious effect in my book.
Well, is there, you know, potentially a little bit of a trap here in, you know, looking at the book figures versus looking at how to do this in reality, or talking to the, you know, local pilots and hugging the ridge line, and then what you actually feel comfortable and do. So like Paul said, you put something in the bank and something else you'll get. I know, Richard, you had said about departing, you'd lift off flaps up, but the climb speed of 600 feet per minute, well, that's, you'd lift up with, 25 degrees of flaps, but the climb speed is clean, right? And I could completely see somebody lifting off, not getting the performance that Paul was talking about, and then not feeling comfortable about, do I put up the flaps now or not? And is there a potential here for a kind of trap that you'd fall into? And is there anything you can do to kind of protect against that and give yourself some objective ways of getting out of that?
You know, Jeff, I think 600 feet a minute climb is plenty. You know, this scenario isn't that demanding. I mean, it is. You've got a high density altitude, but you've got a plane that can perform against it. You've done your calculations. The winds aren't that bad. So, you know, here's a scenario where, yeah, I would feel comfortable departing, you know, as I mentioned. As far as the flaps go, I would use the flaps for takeoff just to get me airborne sooner. But I would, you know, retract the flaps as soon as I reach the right speed and climb flaps up. I mean, I wouldn't do anything different there.
Well, let me then build on a comment that Dave made there. Let's suppose you take off, you retract your flaps, you're climbing, you're getting maybe not 600 feet per minute, but you're climbing. And then you look over at your CHTs and they're just skyrocketing. Now you've suddenly got a trade. You had banked 600 feet per minute, but now you got an engine that's getting really hot, really fast. How are you going to resolve that dilemma, given the fact that you've got rising terrain all around you? How important is that, and how do you deal with it?
Now you got to use some pilotage, right? We got to use that judgment that we've spent, you know, most of our flying careers developing. So all the factors coming together. So here's how I would handle that. Like, how well am I climbing? How hot are they? Do I have the ability to nose over and power back a little bit and still keep a reasonable climb? How much lift am I getting off of the ridge to the east of me? The time I spent out there this summer, it was eye-opening the kind of lift you can get, or on the other side of the valley, the kind of downdraft you can get from those winds, even relatively light winds. So I would factor all those things. And let's say they all go against me. The engine's running really hot. I'm not climbing as well, so I don't have much pitch or power to give to help that scenario. I'm getting no lift off the east side of those mountains. Then I'm going to edge my way around. I've got 4 miles in that valley and come back to the runway and land and realize it was just a bad idea and nothing was working for me. And you've got plenty of room, plenty of power to make that decision.
Not only that, I think this departure would work at 400 feet per minute. It's going to take longer, but you don't have to lower the nose that much to knock the CHTs down. And I think we're making this up here that you're going to get high CHTs because it's turbocharged. It's not that hot a day. The turbo aero has a ton of cooling. In fact, it's overcooled. That's why it's so slow. I mean, it's a real slug. So this is you know, not like like even a Cirrus or a Lancer or something like that that's really tightly strung. A turbo aero is in that airplane. But if it's sunk down to 300 feet a minute, then I think you start to have a problem if you get much lower than that. And people are coming out of there without turbocharged airplanes with low climb rates, and most of them manage.
You know, the way to stack the deck on your favor in this one is to do what Richard said about take off 3.5, hug the hills on the climb out, turn south to get over the valley to gain altitude. If the climb rate isn't satisfactory or anything is of concern, keep going south because there's a river that goes southbound out of that valley. And one thing that you can count on rivers to do is to find the lower elevation. And so if you follow the river downstream, it goes toward Las Vegas, New Mexico. And then the river knows how to find the lower elevations. You can follow that south and you can have a clear path out of the mountains then.
Yeah, I like that. I like that about having sort of multiple plans queued up. And it's sort of, your plan A, your plan B, and if there's kind of a cascade failure of, man, we just can't get out of here, either coming back to that runway or working your way down the valley. You know, it's interesting, even the departing, waiting to depart in the evening, which sounds good, but then, oh, wait, there's going over the mountains at night. Do I really want to do that? Looking towards that terrain, or even backing up, coming into Angel Fire in the first place and focusing in on how do I get into the airport without really walking through all the possibilities of getting out? I mean, how many times do we have that we've thought about landing somewhere and how we were going to get in, what approach we were going to use if we were instrument pilots and how we were going to get to the hotel, and not put a whole lot of thought into the departing of that airport until we were getting ready to depart that airport. And so maybe that's the real takeaway from this whole scenario, is this idea of consequences. Throughout aviation, we are looking at consequences. But this one is interesting in that it is some very long-ranging consequences, and we have to play out multiple possibilities to have multiple escape routes to actually get ourselves safely out and back home.